In this second part of the class, I'm going to start the period, the chronological approach, starting from 1945. I do have some more things to say on general concepts, but I'd like to get into the actual history, and I'll have different parenthèses. Bits in brackets to say along the way. And so, you know, there we are. Le Royaume-Uni à l'épreuve de la crise. Okay. So it's a really interesting title, yeah. À l'épreuve de. Yeah. It's from 1970 to 1979. So that involves now defining the United Kingdom. That's not so hard. We're going to have to at some point have an idea of defining the crisis. Perhaps you know that many historians and many politicians have considered it to be a period of decline, but you know, other people might consider it to be a golden age. Certainly trade unionists often consider it to be a golden age, feminists often consider it to be a golden age, whereas economists much less so. Just a couple of publicity, a couple of short advertising break. These are some of the things that I recommend. Now, you'll say that I recommend them because I wrote some of them, which is true, but on the other hand, it's not surprising that what I wrote in the books is what I think is the most important, so, you know, that's life. On the top right, that's a Kindle book, which I wrote. This one in the middle has a chapter by quite a number of different people, and this one is printed in Britain. Now, in fact, you're rather lucky in a way in that you're in the second year of the question. Because all of this stuff in France, we were desperately writing last year, and so it came out in November or in January. Don't hesitate to begin with what the French have written, because it's mostly written by people who know the aggregation back to France. Yeah. But of the British books, this is by far my favourite, When the Lights Went Out, which really brings to life, it's a big book, huh? Very easy to read. And interviews with lots of people. He will interview, you know, a Conservative minister, and you know, retired Conservative minister, and then a trade unionist, and then an Irish nationalist. I was very impressed. It was very, very wide, and very, I thought, very fair-minded. That is to say, not neutral, but fair-minded. Everybody gets a space to give their opinion in detail, and it's not just him interpreting. Yes, I liked that. These are slightly different. This is a book by Ellipse, and this is more a manuel, that is, that it's more introductory, that each chapter gives you a summary of the situation. Whereas this, the Revue Française de Civilisation Britannique, is a research, where each person has written about their own research on the 1970s. So this is more high level, if you like, and this is more introductory. Now, it doesn't matter if you have been reading this, but if you haven't read it, I don't recommend it, because it's full of anecdotes from popular culture in the 70s, television programs, comedians, and so on, which is great if you lived there in the 70s, but otherwise it's not really aimed at you. It's aimed at people who are old and like to imagine when they were younger and more beautiful, as most of us were. But not all of us. Okay, Crisis, What Crisis, Britain in the 70s. It's a bestseller, but it's a bestseller to British people of my age and not to history students. I like this one by Stéphane Porrion, although, like I say, I find that sometimes it goes into great detail, which it can be too much sometimes, you know, you get a little carried away. Now, of course, when people write books about the 1970s, the titles they choose reflect their priorities. And just here, just a couple of examples. Very well-known book, Why is Britain Becoming Harder to Govern? Written in 1976 by somebody, obviously, whose priority was being a government. Yeah? It's not, the priority is not, this is not written by somebody who's thinking, what is life like to be a woman or a young person? It's a person. What is life like to be the government? Yeah, quite an influential book. And just to give the opposite example, this is a book from 2001 about 1972, Glorious Summer, Class Struggle in Britain in 1972. And when we get to 1972, you'll see why this was considered. 1972 was no doubt the moment in the 20th century, when trade unionists had more power than any other time. Now, one might consider that that's not that much power, because of course it's still the employers who decided if you had a job or not, but nevertheless, trade unions could be really pretty powerful. Just to give you an example, in 1972, the nurses wanted more money because they didn't feel they were very well paid. But it's very difficult for nurses to go on strike in hospital, you know. And in 1972, the miners in Wales went on strike for a day to demand more money for the nurses. So this is a different kind of trade union power, because they always won the strikes for themselves, and so they felt, the nurses are important too. And this is a kind of, something which we don't see today. So, I'm going to begin by the 1945 to 1970 period. As you know, in French we have this wonderful expression for 1945 to 75, which is... Say again? Even more wonderful expression than that. Les Trente Glorieuses, yeah, and now even, as I'm sure that people of your age must be a bit fed up of hearing about the Trente Glorieuses, you know, especially because you were born after them, yeah? And at the same time, we don't use this expression in Britain, we just say the post-war boom. But I like the French expression for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you ever get a chance, not this year because you're on your agrégation, to read the history book by Jean Forestier called Les Trente Glorieuses, it is one of the most wonderful history books around. But more importantly, from the point of view of the historian, the description is not unreasonable. When you go to... If you walk around Britain in 1955... You're a time traveller. You walk around Britain in 1955, and you've visited many, many other decades. Wow. All the children have shoes on. Before the Second World War, ordinary people, you don't buy shoes for children. They grow too quickly. Yeah. If you see all the children have shoes on, yeah. More and more people have toilets inside their houses. People are beginning to have washing machines. Now, of course, washing machine is not very important, except if you don't have a washing machine, and if you have five children. So really, there were a whole load of things which were quite glorious. And just one little example is the glasses. When they opened up the National Health Service in 1948, they didn't know how many people in the country needed glasses. Why didn't they know? Because, first of all, because nobody in government cared. And secondly, because ordinary people didn't go to opticians to have their eyes tested because they didn't have the money to buy the glasses. And they suddenly discovered that there were a need for millions of pairs of glasses, which were free in the new system. And so you've got all these people who... And if you wear glasses, you know, if you couldn't afford to wear them, that's quite a big deal. It can be quite a big deal if you can't afford to wear them. Oh, yes. Some people do have glasses, yes. I can see now, yes. This idea of Les Trente Glorieuses is perhaps not so ridiculous from a certain point of view. Certainly, I will come to more of that in a moment. So, here I have a slide for every... I have a slide for every year. And so here are some of them. So, of course, 1945. And I'm going to make some links with the 1970s whenever I can. Of course, 1945, the end of the war. Here you have VE Day, victory in Europe. It's over in the West. London had joy nights. So, obviously, people were tremendously relieved that it was the end of the war. They had a hard time, a lot of bombing in Britain. Not as much as in France. Because the bombing only lasted for, I think, a year and a half in Britain, until the Battle of Britain. Whereas in France, of course, towns like Caen were completely destroyed. Yeah, the main avenue in Caen was decided by an American general. So they couldn't find the main boulevard because everything was destroyed. So, oh, it's there. Pretty heavy stuff, I'm sure you remember. Oh, you don't remember, do you? I don't remember either. So, end of the war in Europe, and a feeling that, you know, they didn't want it to happen again. The discovery of the death camps. Now, many people knew, but the liberation of the death camps, you can see on the bottom right, was it an important event, and that more information was getting out about them. The first use of atomic weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and this was going to overshadow the history following up to today, because like even today, you know, with the United States and North Korea, we're worried about nuclear missiles, and if you're not worried, you should be. This has been an important thing, and in British history, this will be important because the British elite will decide that they want and need their own nuclear weapons, partly because the United States is not so willing to share nuclear technology, and partly because seems to be a symbol of superpower status. Remember that Britain has a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council. But it's a small country. Why does it have it? Well, nuclear weapons is part of the deal. It's a symbol of international prestige. The other two pictures here on the top right, the publication in 1945 of Animal Farm, which you've probably heard of, by George Orwell, an extremely popular writer at the time, one of the first hands-on intervention journalists, like that other one who does it today in France. What's her name? He used to disguise himself and go and live among different groups of people and then do journalism reports on them. So George Orwell in the 1930s wrote Down and Out in Paris and London, Dans la déche à Paris et à Londres, and he said what life was like living on the streets and so on. Animal Farm is an interesting symbol because it is a fairy story which is generally accepted to be a parody and a criticism of Stalinist Russia. So why a fairy story? Well, it was a complicated time to be anti-Stalinist in 1945. Stalin was very popular in Britain in 1945 because the Russians won the war. And indeed, from some points of view, the Second World War was a war between Germany and Russia, where the other country did a bit. I think there were like 15 million dead in Russia. It was something absolutely stunning. So in any case, in Britain in 1945, Russia was popular. And this was why, especially on the left, George Orwell, who was on the left, when he wrote this great criticism of Stalinist Russia, he called it a fairy story, to try to, you know, to cover himself. So an important writer on the left, and an important question about Russia, which also points up something specific about Britain. If you compare Britain, France, Italy, Germany, Britain is the country, especially compared with France, which never had a mass communist party. So I think the Communist Party, they had one member of parliament, and then perhaps they had two at one point, never more. Whereas in France, the Communist Party has been an important part, especially in the 70s, you know, 56, 70, an important part of the left. In Britain, the Communist Party had influence in the trade unions, but was never a mass party. That's important because it transformed the Labour Party. The Labour Party includes a far bigger variety of politics in the 70s than the Parti Socialiste in the 80s or the SFIO before that. Yeah, because there was no mass communist party, the Labour Party included people who probably in another country would have been in the Communist Party. Yeah? And that's very important. So the distance between the right of the Labour Party, the right of the Labour Party, and the left of the Labour Party is quite big. Finally, last thing for 1945, look at this wonderful poster. Have you two or more children in your family? If so, ask at the counter for a claim form for family allowances. So this is money that you give people to help them with their children. And this, today, is fairly banal, but at the time, people look and say, they're going to give me money to help me feed my children? This is incredible. It's wonderful. These were big changes for people. Although there are many social problems in Britain in the 1970s, you don't have hungry people like in the 1930s. I don't mean nobody was hungry in the 1970s, but in the 1930s you had a lot of hungry people. And this was a problem which had finished in Britain in the 1970s. So we're going to go through year by year The 1945 was marked by the election in 1945, and on the one hand you had Winston Churchill, who had been the leader of the government during the war, and on the other hand the Labour Party, and the Labour Party won. So this might have been, you might consider this to be rather surprising, and Winston Churchill is generally considered to have won the war, and yet he lost the election. How did he manage to do that? Well, there were a number of reasons. First of all, the war was during the war there was a coalition government, including Conservative ministers and Liberal ministers and Labour ministers, and so the Conservative Party did not gain all the prestige from the victory in the war. Secondly, Winston Churchill decided to rely on his personal image. For example, there was not a Conservative Party manifesto in 1945. There was a message from Mr. Churchill to the voters. So it's very, very personal. But the main thing is that Winston Churchill expressed openly his opposition to the welfare state. He said that if you have a national health service, which all doctors must work in, this is rather like fascism. That was the opinion of Winston Churchill. And unfortunately for him, in 1945, the idea, the health service didn't exist yet, but the idea of the health service was the most massively popular idea in the history of Britain. He was on the wrong side on that one. And indeed, even today, the National Health Service, which I will talk about in a moment, is extremely popular in Britain. Extremely popular. And I'll tell you more about that in a moment. Okay, so the Labour Party comes in and they bring in some really quite big reforms, and it opens up a couple of questions. After the Second World War, you can imagine, the British government had spent all its money. And in fact, it's estimated that the Second World War cost 28% of the national wealth. Not 28% of the national income, but 28% of the national wealth, of the value of all the factories and houses and railways and so on, so massive. And yet, they introduced the biggest reforms we'd ever seen. So why was this possible? Because, of course, they didn't know there was going to be a boom. Well, there are a number of reasons, but certainly one of the reasons was that there was an enormous demand for social change, enormous demand for social change. And also the elites was looking back, they knew the history very well, they was looking back at the end of the First World War. And if you look back at the end of the First World War, you have the Russian Revolution in 1917, you have 2 years of strikes in Italy from 1919 to 21, you have two revolutions in Germany, 1919 and 1923, you have strikes and mutinies in Britain in 1919, you have the revolution in Hungary. The elite was they were expecting a series of revolutions around Europe after the Second World War. Now, they were wrong. And indeed, quite often the elite is more scared of revolutions than they really need to be, because the elite believe in revolutions, they believe they're possible, whereas very often the people don't believe they're possible, but the elites are very scared of this. And one Conservative minister said in so many words, if you do not give the people reform, they will give you revolution. Exactly what he said, which is unusual to say. So this is one of the reasons that big reforms were coming in, and the idea of the welfare state, based on the Beveridge Report in 1942. Now, the Beveridge Report was important, but you know, it was just a report. It didn't have to happen. They needed a big demand. Interestingly enough, the Beveridge Report in Britain influenced the Sécurité Sociale in France as well. It was a big thing. And the idea of the Beveridge Report was that the government will look after or take care of the needs of the population from the cradle to the grave. Yeah, from the cradle to the grave. And so included, you know, sickness benefits, retirement benefits, maternity benefits, etc., etc. Just a little point about the vocabulary. Remember the meaning of benefit, which is money which you receive from the government because you have a need. Yeah, housing benefits. So it's a faux ami with bénéfices. So 1946, large whole series of nationalizations. Here you have this colliery is now managed by the National Coal Board on behalf of the people. So you can see then that nationalisation, not just seen as a pragmatic thing to make the coal industry more efficient, but to be seen as a political thing on behalf of the people. It's the people who now have the coal industry. So a political thing. National insurance scheme, which is unemployment insurance for everybody. In the 20s and 30s, a section of workers had unemployment insurance. Not a very big section. And on the bottom right, you have an aeroplane. Why do you have an aeroplane? Because the aircraft industry was nationalised. Of course, there were not so many aeroplanes at the time, but nevertheless, they were civil aviation was nationalised. So you have this series of nationalisations and the setting up of the welfare state. Partly, this was also possible politically because before the Second World War, the Conservatives had said, "Oh, planning and nationalisation are very bad things." Now, in order to win the war, there was a need for massive planning and massive national control of industry. And so in 1945, the Labour Party said, well, look, nationalisation helped us win the war, planning helped us win the war, so now it can help us win the peace. That the political argument was much more easy in 1945 than it had been in the 1930s. The other thing that the problem had for the Conservatives is that from 1931 to 1939, you had either a Conservative government or a national government dominated by the Conservatives. So although Winston Churchill, the Conservative, had played a big part in winning the war, people thought, if we get a Conservative government back, we will have the 1930s again. They'd been affected by that. So this is what's going in 1946. The question of nationalisation will come up again in the 1970s, will begin to come up again in the 1970s. In the 1980s, certainly many of the nationalised companies will be privatised. Again, but in the 1970s, this will already be there as an argument, as a political argument. We'll see in the manifesto. Nationalisation, is it a good thing, or is it a bad thing? That will be one of the arguments going on. That's one of the links to the 1970s. 1947 is a big year because, as you can see on the top right, India became independent. I don't know if any of you had the time yesterday night to watch the film Gandhi, which was on television last night. Fabulous film. And so India became independent. This is a huge event. This was by a very, very long way the biggest of Britain's colonies. Of course, because there are millions and millions of... In fact, it's a whole amazing story that a tiny country like England could control an enormous country like India. This independence, which had been the Indians had been fighting for independence, well, the independentists had been fighting since 1911, 1912, or even before, I think, Congress. Very early on in the 20th century. I'm not very good with dates. But the main thing is that once India became independent, every colony had a section that said, hey, if India can become independent, hey, maybe we can as well. Yeah, so that was the beginning of the end, and certainly the whole period up to 1970 is the period of decolonization. And this will continue to be important in the 1970s, first of all, because there are two or three colonies which are still in conflict about independence in the 1970s, notably Cyprus and Rhodesia. But also because the immigration into Britain of a certain number of families from the ex-colonies, and this will be a big question in the 1970s. The questions of racism in the 1970s will be at the centre of political debate, and indeed. There are many different kinds of racism, but certainly, if you take the everyday racism like how people are treated just when they're at school, just when they're at work, the everyday racism. There's no doubt it was much, much worse in the 1970s than today. I was at school in the 1970s, and I probably heard a racist joke every week. There was nothing surprising about racist jokes. If you look at some of the comedy videos which I've put on the blog, there's some really racist stuff. I've only put it on for purely historical interest because I think, oh, Jesus Christ, how would people look at this stuff? You know, but that's what it was like. The 1970s was, now, I don't want to exaggerate, there's plenty of racism in Britain today, but the 1970s was, it was just much worse. It was just much worse. What else was going on in 1947 then? Well, the nationalisation of the railways. And that's their original symbol, yeah, a lion on a wheelbarrow. Which will remain nationalised until the 1990s. And I have two flags there and I can't remember why. So it's just somewhere, what was it, 47, so I can't remember why that was there. Sorry, I forgot what the flag
Ireland,
are. No, it isn't. No.
It was in Ireland in 47.
It's Sri Lanka. It's Sri Lanka.
Okay.
It was Ceylon and it's Sri Lanka. They must be becoming independent. Yeah, it does look like the Irish one, but it's got the
but
thing in the middle.
What happens in Ireland in 47?
I have no idea.
It became a republic in
1949. Ah, 49. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. And nothing happened at all in Ireland in 1947. They just sat there all year. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So moving forward, 1948, and the big thing about 1948, then the establishment of the National Health Service, that's Aneurin Bevan, he's the health minister. And in Britain, he is a working class hero. People of my mother's generation, or of my generation, you know, they won't hear anything against Aneurin Bevan. Because before the Second World War, most people went to get the doctor. Remember, you can't phone the doctor, you don't have a phone. Went to get the doctor if their children were ill, but if an adult was ill, you didn't go to get the doctor because it was too expensive. That was typical. That was typical, you just didn't do it. And from 1948, they established the National Health Service on the principle that healthcare is free at the point of use. Now, free at the point of use means it is not reimbursed. It is not refunded because you don't pay. You just don't pay anything. Yeah, so you don't need a mutuel, you don't need a comprehensive health service, you don't need, in fact, you don't even need a card, you know. And this is still the case today. And British people are extremely proud of the National Health Service to such an extent. In 2012, when you had the Olympics in Britain, the opening ceremony, there was a whole section on the National Health Service. Yeah, it really is something that the British people are very proud of. And indeed, I have a little experience of it because about 3 years ago, I was in London. I had an accident, and an ambulance came and they took me off to hospital and they x-rayed me and bandaged me up. It was nothing serious. And nobody asked me for my name or my address or asked me for any money. Yeah, and I was just—I was—I must admit—I was very impressed. They didn't even ask me. The only person who asked me for my name was the person in the ambulance when they say, "Tell me what your name is," you know, to see if you can still see them. Yes, so that's still the case. And of course, what's special about this is that once the government has introduced free healthcare at the point of use, it is extremely difficult to take it back. Yeah. And even Margaret Thatcher, and of course, she would have liked. People to pay some of the cost of healthcare because it's a standard neoliberal policy, but it was just impossible. This is important because what is politically possible changes from place to place. And let me give you an example. As you know, in Britain, if you go to university, you pay £8,000 a year, something like that, as enrolment. And in France, you don't. You pay much, much less. Now, I'm sure there are some politicians in France who think the British system is better. However, at election time, No French politician will say, I think that students should pay, you know what, 12,000 euros a year. Because it's political suicide to say something like that. You could just imagine, you know, absolutely. Even if they think it. And this is, you have to remember that politics, parliamentary politics, is a very pragmatic sort of thing. That you write your manifesto within the framework of what is politically possible. And some things are not politically possible. So, there we go. This is also the year, 1948, when George Orwell wrote his book, 1984, because he just took the last two figures and shifted them around. Which, if you ever write a science fiction book about the future, don't put a date, don't give the title as a date, because, you know, at some point it won't be the future anymore. And this is also in international relationships, the time of the Berlin airlift. That is to say that Berlin, which was in the middle of East Germany, was cut off from the West. After the Second World War, Germany was divided into two, West Germany, East Germany, two different spheres of influence. And Berlin was also divided into two, West Berlin and East Berlin. But Berlin was in the middle of East Germany. And so to get forward and backward from West Berlin, they had to take for a long time they had a closed road, but they could go, but they couldn't get out of it. This time a particular tension between the Soviet Union and the West. The Soviets blocked the road, and for 15 months everything in West Berlin was taken by aeroplanes. I think they had 100 aeroplanes every day, you know, with water and all sorts of stuff. So it's obviously a sign of tension. This is the Cold War. But also it's a sign that it is the Cold War, because the West was not tempted to try a military solution. Yeah, they didn't want to risk a war with Russia. 1949 in the international field is the founding of NATO. This followed, if I remember correctly, hard upon the founding of the Warsaw Treaty Organization. Although for a long time in the West, we talked about NATO and the Warsaw Pact. Now you can notice the choice of vocabulary. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that sounds very respectable, but the Warsaw Pact is a very evil sort of word, it's pact, at least in English. And it's also the time of the Parliament Act, which reduced again the power of the House of Lords. Oh, moving forward to 1950, and I've chosen two events in 1950 which have echoes for the 1970s. Now, I do this to some extent, choose events which have echoes for the 1970s, because of course the 1970s is what we're interested in, but we have to be a little careful. You must remember that people did not live through the 1950s and 1960s preparing for the 1970s. That they weren't doing that, yeah. The reason for the 1950s is not to prepare the 1970s. So sometimes, if you look back, if you only look at the things which have echoes in the 1970s, you get a false view of history. The other thing I wanted to say, which I'd forgotten, was about Le Trente Glorieuse, and I have to say this in French, ce qui ne faut pas oublier les Trente Glorieuses, c'est que après 28 années des Trente Glorieuses, les gens, ils n'étaient pas là à se dire, ah, il ne reste que deux ans. And this is very important, because during the post-war boom, no unemployment, or almost no unemployment in 1955, almost no unemployment in 1960, almost no employment in 1965, almost everybody believed that mass unemployment had disappeared forever. Yeah. They did it that way. Oh, it wasn't a period to them. It was the end, you know. 30 years without, you know, 25 years without, we'd never seen this. And so they were convinced, and this is one of the reasons why in the 1970s, when mass unemployment comes back, it's a bigger shock, because people were convinced it had finished forever, yeah, because that's how people think, yeah. Whereas now we probably tend to think the opposite, yeah. Two events from 1950 which give echoes in the 1970s. First of all, British troops were sent to fight in Korea. This is the Korean War. We don't talk a lot about the Korean War. We talk more about the Vietnam War. The reason we talk about the Vietnam War is because Vietnam won against America, which is absolutely incredible. It's a tiny little country at the other end with, and they won against, I mean, nobody could believe it yet, so the Vietnam War was, we talk about it a lot. However, the Korean War was also a very serious affair. More than 1 million people were killed. But from the point of view of Britain, the British sent troops to fight in Korea. And I might have a little bit of detail in this. 4,000 British troops were sent to fight in Korea. Now, from the point of view of the Korean War, 4,000 was not a lot of troops. Militarily, it was not very important. It was mostly a political support for the Americans. And two things to notice about this. First of all, Britain has often been an important political support for America. It may be in the 1990s that without British support, the Americans would have found it politically impossible to have the war in Iraq. That's possible. Militarily, it makes no difference. Britain is small. But politically, that's an interesting question. The second thing of this relates more directly to the 1970s, is that in the 1970s, the 1960s and the 1970s, how many British troops went to fight with the Americans in Vietnam? Trick question, zero. And the experience of Korea was one of the reasons which made, especially Harold Wilson and then Edward Heath, say to the Americans, who are very powerful people, who are very useful allies because trade, economy, loans, etc., are important people. And every prime minister during the Vietnam War said to the Americans, oh, no, we did that, we're not doing that again. Yeah. And that's quite important. I mean, I don't think it was decisive. The most decisive thing with the Vietnamese fighting back in their tunnels, but so the troops are fighting Korea in 1950. And the other one, anybody have any idea what this is? It looks absolutely ridiculous. I don't even know how to pronounce it. I think it's the Stone of Scone. The Stone of Scone is stolen now. The Stone of Scone is a part of Scottish history, and it is a stone on which the Scottish kings were always consecrated every time for hundreds of years. So it's an important symbolic stone of Scottish history. And in the 1950s, it was in London, in Westminster Abbey. I think it was Westminster Abbey or in some place in... Yes, from Westminster Abbey. Now, say again.
It's not related to the... Can you eat the scone? I mean, is that where scones come from?
Probably.
It looks a little bit like a scone.
Like, it does, yeah. I think you might need a lot of butter.
Yes. Well, usually you put yeah, butter on
the scone. That's true. That would be rather a lot. Sacred part of Scottish heritage was in Westminster Abbey. The Scottish nationalists were not happy with it being in London, and so they stole it. And it was found a few months later in an abbey in Scotland. So it was a symbolic nationalist act. Now, this is important for the 1970s because the 1970s will be a period of high water for the Scottish nationalists. At one point in the 1970s, they will have 11 members of parliament. This rises slowly. The Scottish National Party rises slowly through the 50s and 60s. The Scottish National Party, I think, is founded in the 1920s, and it's a very interesting name, Scottish National Party, not Scottish Nationalist Party. And that's because they wanted a party which included those who wanted independence and a bit more too. They wanted a wider, broader thing. And in the 1970s, the Scottish National Party will make considerable progress. And in particular, they will understand at some point, they will understand that campaigning for an autonomous parliament is a good idea. Now, this might sound obvious to you. But at the time, this was a big argument in the Scottish National Party, because some people were saying, oh, yes, it would be nice to have a Scottish Parliament which deals with health and education, because it will be a first step to independence. And another section of the party says, oh, no, if you accept an autonomous Parliament, we'll never have independence. It's instead of independence. We don't want it. And so you've got a division inside the Scottish Nationalist Party, which is the best way. And in fact, the people who campaigned for an autonomous parliament, it seems today, it's easy for us to see today, that they were right, because once the Scottish Parliament was established, you had in 1997, you very quickly had a Scottish National Party government in Scotland dealing with health and education on a few things, but showing how their party could be a government and therefore helping the opinion for independence. So these are complicated political questions which will be important in the 1970s. So we move on to 1951. We find that Churchill becomes Prime Minister again. He comes out of retirement and becomes Prime Minister again in 1951. How is this possible? He was rejected when he said that the National Health Service is like fascism. We don't want planning and nationalisation. We'll have no freedom. In 1945, Churchill gave a list of six priorities, and number six was housing. Unfortunately, that was the number one priority of the population, and they didn't want to see it in number six. But Churchill comes back then, the leader of the Conservative Party, new Prime Minister, but he has a completely different team around him, and he surrounds himself with a team which accepts that the welfare state is not going away, that you cannot oppose the National Health Service, it's politically impossible. And so the new Conservative government in 1951 will not oppose the welfare state, and indeed they will continue building hundreds of thousands of public houses. I think at one point the Conservative government in the 1950s is building 300,000 houses a year. So this shows a few things. First of all, it shows that the economy is going quite well, and so the government has a lot of money. But secondly, it shows that, you know, that politicians have to decide what is possible. And what was possible in the 1950s was not opposing the welfare state. And indeed, the Conservatives become proud of the fact that they build a lot of public housing. As a general rule, the Labour Party is more in favour of public housing, and the Conservative Party more in favour of private housing. And this goes on very much in the 1970s. There's a lot of debate about what rights should the owner have and what rights should the tenant have. You know, for example, I don't know exactly what the law is in Britain. I know more about it in France. But you know, in many countries, if the owner wants you to move, they can't just make you move. You have a contract and you have a certain security of tenure. And the argument in the 1970s between the Labour and Conservatives is Labour saying, well, we want more security for the tenant, and the Conservatives saying, well, we want less security for the tenant. Because the natural position of the Conservative Party was, you must think, what is it like when you rent a flat to somebody? And the natural position of the Labour Party was, what is it like when you rent a flat from somebody? So it's just two positions, both of which exist, but you know, it's a matter of who you're thinking, because of course both of these groups have problems, but you might consider one group's problems to be more of a priority than the others. So in any case, in the 1950s, the Conservative Party are involved in building the welfare state and the public housing and all the other aspects of the welfare state. The welfare state is much wider than we think. For example, food safety. 100 years ago, if you bought food and it was rotten and you were poisoned, well, that's bad luck. It was not considered necessarily to be a government problem. And indeed, the welfare state is a gradual expansion of what is a government problem. Yeah, more and more things are a government problem. And certainly today, you know, if in the supermarkets there is poisonous food, and there was an example recently, if it's one incident, if there's a lot, people blame the government. Because you know, because that's what we brought up in the welfare state. This brings me to the question of the post-war consensus, or the post-war settlement, or the post-war compromise. And these are not exactly the same. What would you say was the post-war consensus?
Post-war consensus?
Could you define it in a couple of sentences?
I mean, both parties accepted that the welfare state was necessary, and they went on with the welfare state until Margaret Thatcher then attacked the welfare state, attacked the public sector. So I think until Margaret Thatcher became prime minister, the welfare state was agreed upon by both parties.
Okay, that's pretty good. That's pretty good definition. I liked how you begin, sir. Both parties accepted. So they might like it or not like it, but they accept it. And this is why, in many ways, I prefer post-war settlements to post-war consensus. See, a consensus is we have the same opinion. It's a consensus.
Because cost was spiraling out of control.
In the 70s and 80s.
Right.
Yeah, and at the same time, there was more and more wealth being made. It's a long one. Whereas a settlement is accepting what is possible. So Winston Churchill accepted that in the present political climates, you had to build a lot of public houses if you wanted to win an election. There's nothing dishonourable about that. You know, of course, leaders of parties want to win elections because if you're in a political party, you have ideas about what is the best way to organise society. And if you lose the election, you won't be able to put your ideas into practice. And so, quite naturally, you want to win the election. And you're prepared to make some compromises in order to win the election because you believe that your ideas are better. I think that's an important thing to remember. Actually, we live in a cynical period, and I think if you're a historian, you're not really allowed to be cynical. So, for example, to consider one of my students wrote a couple of months ago, Margaret Thatcher hated the poor. Now, first of all, this is almost impossible to prove, but secondly, you can't really understand history like that. That the best way to understand history is to assume that Margaret Thatcher or Winston Churchill had sincere beliefs about how society would work better. You don't have to agree with them, but yeah. Most politicians are involved in politics because of what they think is best for the society. Firstly, in Western democracies, if you want to become very rich, politics is not a good place to go. Yeah. I mean, you know, for people from the elites, I'm not talking about ordinary people, for people from the elite, you make far more money in business than you do in politics. Yeah. So it's not generally the case. And secondly, of course, if you become a politician, that what happens to you typically is that you become a county councillor and remain a county councillor for 50 years and never become either rich or famous and just have people knocking on your door on a Sunday because they have problems with their landlord. I'm getting carried away. Let's get back to the post-war consensus. Yes, so it is this idea that there's a certain number of parameters which cannot be changed. The welfare state, the role of trade unions. Now, of course, on average, conservative governments are not very keen on trade unions. On the other hand, the political situation in Britain is that trade unions, even today, have 6.5 million or 6 million members. In 1979, they had 12 million members. You will never hear Margaret Thatcher when she becomes leader of the Conservative Party in 1975. She will never say we need to get rid of trade unions. Now she's allowed to dream this at home in private, but the public position is pragmatic. You can't get rid of trade unions in a modern society. What can you do? You can work on reducing their power, reducing their popularity by explaining to people why you think they've gone too far. Many, many things you can do, but they're all within a context that, of course, trade unions are part of modern society, and so you can't publicly be against trade unions. In any case, in a democratic society, you can't, because even today in Britain there are 6 million members of trade unions. So that's a lot of people to put in prison, you know. So that's why in the post-war period until today, it's only been the extreme right or fascist organisations who wanted to see trade unions abolished, because that was not part of the parameters. Moving on, we have 1952. And 1952 has a number of things going on. First of all, on the right, you see Britain tests her first atomic bomb off the West Australian coast. It's not very nice for the Australians, but fun for the British. And this is then part of the process whereby the British elite decided they wanted British nuclear weapons and not participation with American nuclear weapons. This can be slightly problematic because if the British government wanted British nuclear weapons, that meant, first of all, you must have nuclear power stations. You cannot make nuclear weapons without nuclear power stations. It's technically impossible because the plutonium is only produced in nuclear power stations. Secondly, it costs a lot of money. Thirdly, interestingly enough, this plan for British nuclear weapons was established by the Labour Prime Minister Clement Attlee in 1946-1947 secretly, not even all his ministers were told. Now, having said that, it probably would not have caused a public uproar if he had announced it. On the bottom left, you see a ration book, because, of course, you had rationing during the war, but when the war finishes, you don't automatically have enough of everything. It takes a long time. Rationing continued until 1952. In fact, rationing got worse in 1949 and 1950. This is important because it was, nevertheless, a time of quite severe austerity. Rationing was popular during the war for a very simple reason. If you don't have rationing, the prices go up very high. Basically, if you don't have rationing, only the rich eat meat. So it's a democratic measure, but obviously quite painful. And on the top left, you see the Land and Freedom Movement, which was a campaign in Kenya against British rule, Kenya being one of the bigger British colonies. Now, the whole period of decolonization goes on throughout this period. Whether the British elite were lucky or whether the British elite were intelligent, I don't know, but they managed to go through the entire period of decolonization without a major war. There was no guerre d'Algérie or equivalent in British thing. Now, some people have said this is because the British elite were so intelligent. I don't know. But it is an important question because, for example, the Algerian war made a big difference to French politics. It made a huge difference to Algerian politics, of course, but made a big difference to French politics. So you don't get that in France. The most violence around the decolonization place is in Kenya. And just recently, a group of Kenyans received compensation from a British court for torture, which they had undergone in the 1950s under British rule. You can read the stories, but they're really not fun at all. Colonialism is often not original in the way that it treats the different people. So, every year there are about 200 British colonies that become independent between 1945 and 1970. It's 100, many of them small. Sometimes with a certain amount of goodwill. Very often the Queen is invited to the independence celebrations. Strange idea, but that did happen. And of course, the British tried to maintain some influence by establishing the Commonwealth, which, very interesting. It was called the British Commonwealth, and then it was called the Commonwealth, because they were trying to make out that it wasn't about maintaining British interest. Moving through the 1950s, 1953. Coronation of Elizabeth she became queen of, I think, six countries, including South Africa and Pakistan at the time. There you have some school children celebrating the coronation. The coronation was one of the events which made people watch more television. She was crowned Queen of England and South Africa, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Ceylon, and Pakistan. Ceylon, which would later be Sri Lanka. This is also the year when Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay conquered Everest. And this is a very fascinating story. This is a picture of Tenzing Norgay on Everest, and the story of Everest tells you a lot about the history of racism in Britain. Because when I was young in the 60s, they used to say Edmund Hillary conquered Everest, and nobody mentioned the Tenzing Norgay, who was the Sherpa, the local guide. Yeah, because he wasn't white, so he wasn't interesting. Yeah, and then a little later they used to say Edmund Hillary and Sherpa Tenzing. You know, they didn't give him his first name; they just gave him the name of his people. You know, it's all pretty racist. However, there is the interesting story to this is that there are no photographs of Edmund Hillary on the summit of Everest. No, he took the photograph. He took this photograph. But that's interesting because I suspect, I can't prove it, but I suspect that Edmund Hillary understood something about racism. And he understood that if there was a photograph of him, of the white man, it would be the only photograph in every newspaper in the world. And so he did. I like to think that anyway. Certainly, Edmund Hillary worked to help the Sherpa people for many, many years after this. In 1954, there was a couple of things which have echoes in the 1960s, 1970s, some which are important anyway. On the top right, you see there is a new law about broadcasting, a new law about television. Now, television has always been interesting, radio and television has always been interesting, because in general, in democratic societies like Britain, we consider that there shouldn't be an official government newspaper. Oh, that's not very democratic, an official government newspaper. But we normally consider that there should be official government television, the public television. Unless the same in France, you have public television, but you don't have public newspapers. So I don't know why. But in any case, in 1954, it's important because the Television Act, so the Conservative government, of course, introduced a Television Act to end the BBC monopoly and to allow the establishment of private television channels, and you have a picture of one of them there, Granada Television. The television channels are regional, are regionally based, one for each region, and the government organises the granting of licences. So more competition in television, and this will transform television, because of course even the BBC must change its television because of the competition. In the 70s, at the beginning of the 70s, there were two channels. No cable, no satellite, no video recorders, no DVDs, no YouTube. Yeah, there were two channels. And so, first of all, if you wanted to switch on the television, you had to get up from your chair and walk over and press the button. But secondly, you used to watch the television and say, oh, this isn't very good. What's on the other side? Because there are only two sides. There's a BBC and ITV. A little later, there are three in the middle of the 1970s. Of course, in black and white, naturally enough. I feel very old when I teach this class. 1954, also important because there's a very famous, a very high-level case where Lord Montague is jailed for homosexual relations. He is sent to jail for 12 months. Many homosexuals were sent to jail, but he was a lord. So it's on the front page of the newspaper. Homosexual relations are illegal until 1967. And this is, 1954, it's 60 years ago, 63 years ago. This is probably the issue where more has changed than any other issue. A few years ago, a Conservative government in Britain introduced the right to marriage for gays. If in the 1970s you'd said, oh, you know, I've seen into the future and the Conservative government will introduce equal marriage for gays, so you know, you must stop taking those drugs, you know. And it was just that was something absolutely absolutely impossible. And this is also the period of the publication of the Lord of the Rings, then one of the great fantasy novels, which has become, of course, more popular recently because of the films, but also had quite popular. It was very popular in the 1970s because it was taken by the hippie, the people who were close to hippie culture. They loved the Lord of the Rings. Was a very which was very surprising for Tolkien, who was an old-fashioned English conservative gentleman, and could not understand why all these big anarchist sorts loved his book. There you go. And in 1955, of a new prime minister, Anthony Eden, there is a debate launched about the end of capital punishment. Should hanging be stopped? Because the last woman to be hanged in Britain is hanged in this year, Ruth Ellis, for having murdered her lover. This is a rather tragic story, and one of the things that was used as an argument is that after she was executed, her father and her son both committed suicide. And so this was one of the arguments which was used, that, you know, that there is more going on. Capital punishment is suspended in 1964 and abolished in 1969. So in fact, it's abolished before the beginning of our period. However, the debate continues. In the 1970s, you regularly have television debates about this, and one of them is on my video list. And it's quite interesting because it shows where people were at. And certainly in school, when I was in high school, they would regularly have, oh, let's have a debate about capital punishment, you know, every year. A debate about capital punishment. It's one of these boring subjects that you had to keep going at. This is also the year where the situation in Cyprus became complicated. Now, the British had colonies around the world, and some of them were rather unusual. Perhaps the most unusual was Hong Kong, which was decolonized in what year?
2000.
Yeah, 2000. Yeah, 1999 to be precise. 1 minute before 2000. But yes, yeah. So, which is quite recent, really. And Cyprus, which is special because it's in the middle of Europe, which is where normally colonies are elsewhere. The British had always dominated Cyprus by putting the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots against each other. And we will see this come up again later on, because there is a risk of a war between the Greece and Turkey, which obviously was quite a shocking thing. And last year for today, 1956, just to give you an idea of the atmosphere, somebody proposed an anti-smoking campaign, and the health minister refused it because he said there was no clear evidence that smoking was dangerous. And here you have a wonderful poster of the time. Things have changed very quickly on smoking. When I began to work in university in 1988 in Nanterre, I smoked during my classes. Yeah. It wasn't authorized, but it didn't shock anybody. Yeah. I can't do it anymore. It's terrible. Okay, this is also the time of the Suez Crisis, and I'm going to leave that till next week because it's a little bit complicated. So we're beginning to get through the post-war period, and next week I think we'll probably get to the 1970s. So I'll see most of you tomorrow morning for the TEM. Otherwise, don't forget where everything happens, which is at the... On the blog. I haven't put the blog there, but I put it on the other one here before. Thank you for your attention.